good space time, y'all. In this episode of the Citizen Cosmos podcast, I speak to Chris Castiglione, founder at Console XYZ, a Web3 chat for decentralized communities. Along with Chris, we talk about digital identities, good and bad robots and humans, personal rights, startups, education, and product market fit. We also discuss the dangers of wrong funding, the golden billion, onboarding users, and the original vision of the internet.
I think if we could understand the original vision for the web and then understand how it failed or the challenges with it, which I would say are the powers of centralization that came in the early 2000s, then I think you can start to understand what a better future might be. There's never been a more exciting time since maybe the 90s with the web. What Web3 does really well is, I think of it as like a bunch of different Lego blocks that we can interconnect. It's open, it's transparent, it's on the blockchain.
They turn people into bots, into the bots you're describing.
They turn people into bots, yes. So, okay, you don't have enough money, now you have to give up your like eye retina scan.
Before we rock it off into today's podcast, here is a roundup of the latest news from the sponsor of this episode, Cyber. The Cyber Congress DAO has been primarily working on improving the Bostrom Hub. This work includes testing of the contracts, new UI features, verification tools for on-chain governance, and polishing the Bostrom DEX, adding MEV protection, new web front, and bringing indexing of chain swaps. To try Bostrom, head now to oversib.ai.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of Citizen Cosmos podcast. Everybody, I have with me Chris from Console XYZ today on the show. Chris, hi.
Hey, Serge. Happy to be here.
Happy to have you. First thing is first, the most typical thing in the world. Let's introduce yourself, please, for everybody, for me and the listeners. Tell us about what you do and anything else you want to include in the introduction.
Yeah, my name's Chris. Most people call me Castig, just like C-A-S-T-I-G. So that's where you'll find me on all social and everything, Castig. And I am the co-founder of Console. We started Console in the summer of 2021. So it's been a little over a year now. And Console is, it started as Web3 chat, and we're really evolving it into so much more with really everything that like communities need. We think of it as like the future of creative community. So I'm sure we'll get into a bit more of that. But that's the main project that we're building right now. There's a team of 10 of us, and we're pretty well funded and have a pretty great vision. In addition to that, I am an adjunct professor at Columbia University Business School, where I teach a course on coding and Web3. So that's a fun project as well. And before this, my last company was an education company, a technical or coding education company called 1Month. We went through Y Combinator. And prior to that, I've been involved or helped start up a handful of other startups. So I think startups has mostly been my journey, was a developer for a while, now basically heading product for the team.
Nice. Where did you say you teach, Castig? I missed.
Columbia University.
Wow, cool. And you teach computer science? Is it an introductory course or a basic or what is it?
So it's in the business school. So imagine it's a bunch of people who are MBAs and want to start companies, and they need to know the foundations of coding, of Web3, of databases, of all this stuff. So it's like a foundations class of like the least amount that you need to know to like hire, manage, and like get started. That's what the course is.
And how do the students like are interested in computer science? I'm curious, the business guys.
Yeah. The class is it's very popular. It usually sells out or they bid. They have a bidding system, about 70 students every semester. And I don't know that they care so much about computer science, but they love building things, you know? And so they want to just like build tech and hire people to do it, manage people to do it and co-create. So the class is called Digital Literacy. That's the focus of it.
Cool. And I know you started in Berkeley, right?
Berkeley? Just in my dreams. Berkeley, California? Sounds beautiful. But no, I'm from the New York City area. Yeah.
Why did somebody feed me this disgusting information? This is what happens. This is like, no, I'm joking. But for some reason, I saw somewhere that, and I don't know how did it come into here. The reason I was going to ask that, cards on a table, is I have noticed that a lot of crypto people are from Berkeley. Like there is a huge, huge community. And I was like going to go into all conspiracy theories right now, but that's it. I'm not going to do it. So, But still, a topic I do have for you is that I wanted to ask your opinion about, to be more precise, is education and the role of education in society today. And how do you see Web3 fitting into all that? So I know it's like kind of a vague, huge subject that you can probably go on for weeks, but in general, do you think that today Web3 is an educational enough space? Does it need to be more educational? Do we need more people to educate people, or do we let people educate them by themselves since it's the free market? What's your opinion on all this topic? What do we need to do to improve the literacy, let's say, about Web3 in general, in the community, in the society?
Yeah, Serge, education is a large part of what you're doing here, right, with Citizen Cosmos and the podcast and everything. So I really appreciate that. I think education is the key to a better, happier future for everyone. I think as a teacher myself, and as someone who, I read pretty voraciously, like I just love reading. I think just ideas to me are just like so exciting. And I think Web3 itself is like at this moment built on a lot of ideas for the future with a lot of money from mostly Andreessen Horowitz. That's kind of a joke, but it's kind of true. And I think a lot of just really talented people. And so I'm excited about the movement and everything that it stands for. But to answer your question specifically, I think we need education about how we got here. And the problems with today's web, because as I kind of just painted this picture, I think people are arriving at Web3 for the first time and kind of seeing this amazing future that it could bring for us. But I feel like without the past, we repeat a lot of the problems in the future. And so specifically, for example, understanding that the internet itself, which was invented in the 60s and 70s, was built for decentralization, was built for the people, right? A lot of the principles that we're talking about Web3 really came from kind of near Berkeley, kind of California, San Francisco, that whole area, right? During that time. And I think if we could understand the original vision for the web and then understand how it failed or the challenges with it, which I would say are the powers of centralization that came in the early 2000s, then I think you can start to understand what a better future might be. So this is a very broad picture that I'm painting here. And I think, you know, this is a lot of what I teach as well, with kind of understanding the past of how we got here and where we're going. But I think when we talk about Web3 and education, I think understanding the problems, how we got here, and then understanding the solutions and not the other way around.
What are the problems that you're talking about? Because this is like, I think, the main elephant in the room, right? Those problems.
Yeah. Well, one thing that people on the web understand, I think, today, especially if you're on Discord or social media, is that these platforms are overrun by spam and bots. Right now, if I go on Twitter, my inbox is full of just like a bunch of bots trying to sell me, I don't know, some weird crypto kitty or something. So spam and bots are a big thing that plagues the internet. If we can understand the way that like identity works right now on the internet, you have an Instagram account, you have a podcast account, a Riverside account, you have a Facebook account, you have all these accounts. And with each one of them, you have a username and a password. So the way the web is designed right now is your identity is stored with every website that you go to. Facebook has part of your identity. Instagram has part of your identity. And because of that, it provides a lot of challenges. One of those, as I'm mentioning, is the amount of spam and bots we get. The reason those two things are linked is because when we have our, within, let's say, we'll use like Instagram, right? When it's so easy to just spin up accounts and have no history and just kind of show up on Instagram, it's really easy to just not know who is real and who is basically, you know, a scammer or a bot or something, right? And so we have this problem of like personhood on the internet. And those are some of the challenges that Web3 are looking to solve with, some people call it proof of humanity, or there's different metrics for how we can show that people are there. But I think one of the main ideas to look at in the future, which I think is going to really take off in the next year, is removing identity from the platform so that there's one global identity I have. For example, my castig.eth is my ENS name. And my ENS name can be my global identity that I can go and then use and access hundreds of websites. But then I can leave those websites and no one that works at those websites knows I was there. I don't leave a huge fingerprint. They can't deplatform me. I am just using them like a platform and leaving with my identity and leaving with my data. I think that's one of the big shifts in how things have been and where things could be going.
I think the whole DID topic is decentralized identification topic is a really interesting one. And I've had several guests throughout the course of the last few years that we've discussed this with. And I think one of the most common questions I have for them, which I will definitely want to hear your opinion on, why do we need all that if we already have a public and a private key pair? I mean, isn't that enough to have understanding of proof of any identity? There is a private public key. We don't need to collect any more data. That's it. There is the whole deal solved. Is that enough or do we need more?
Yeah, the private public key is a really great first step. And I think in some ways you're right. You mean, there haven't been, to my knowledge of the research that I've done, I haven't seen so many bot accounts with private public keys, although it definitely exists, but it hasn't really like infiltrated kind of my daily Web3 experience. And at the same time, I think that's just because the scale is so small, but I would be concerned that with just a private public key, there's not enough friction, I would say, that you could try, you could create, and people have created them. They do exist, like ways of just spinning up private public keys, like automated, right? And so I think we could see a future where that's not enough. I think you're right. Right now, it's enough. By adding friction, by friction, I mean, in some ways, like a cost can be a type of friction. By making it a little bit harder to interact with me, like if we have a conversation on an app or, you know, we're chatting, by having to purchase like a domain name, right? Like an ENS name or something. That right there, it's just $5 a year, removes 80% of bots that it won't be cost effective to have thousands of millions of bots if you get to spend them up for $5 and then they immediately get banned. With email, email's free right now. We just spin up a bunch of emails, right? So I think it's in combination, having that friction can be a big game changer that will really, I think, just help me. I think that's what Elon Musk is trying to do right now. You know, that's exactly like his move with the blue check mark. His idea is like, look, if somebody's paying $8 a month, it adds a certain type of friction that shows that this person's real. And not only that, but they value the account. And I think it's a similar shift in how we can view the web. Not only is the user, so I'll just add one more thing. I don't think it's the user who has the blue check mark or the ENS name in Web3, but think about that on the other side, the receiving side. I can then set up my for myself parameters for who I can talk with and who I can let talk with me. I can say, hey, and so on console, what we're building, I can say, I only want people to randomly DM me who have an ENS name and 6 months of on-chain activity, right? Like that becomes a level of friction that makes it difficult for automated bots to impersonate.
So private and public key with economical incentives.
Yeah. So,
but I mean, okay, but let me be a bit of devil's advocate. I definitely have more console questions for you. But before we get to there, you said a couple of things. And of course, we're talking in stigmas here, but devil's advocate in me is being loud. You said, for example, it's $5 per year. And this is one thing in crypto that is to me, you know, we spoke about decentralization, we spoke about things. And this is a question to you that for me is very hard to understand. And I always ask my guests, well, 2/3 of the world or roughly 1/3 of the world live about $1 per month. So $5 per year is a lot, it's a hell of a lot of money for some people. And a lot of the folks in crypto sometimes forget that we are not making a product just for the golden billion. You know, we're making a product for the whole world. A bank the unbanked. They might be unbanked the banked. You know, we don't need the banked. We need the unbanked. We need people to go out there. I mean, I know I'm playing devil's advocate right now, but this is kind of the point. But isn't it a lot of money, $5 per year? Shouldn't we like strive to the point of eliminating that cost and letting everybody use not just that one golden billion that lives in the Western Northern Hemisphere?
Yeah, you're totally right. So the way I see a lot of tech solutions or just like a lot of progress in the world is I think there's short-term and longer-term benefits. And I think it's easy to look at the short-term innovations and then say, hey, it doesn't work for every single person in the world. Fuck it. Like, this thing's stupid. I think we see that with anything that happens in American politics where I am right now, where it's like some achievement happens, but it affects one part of the population incorrectly and we naysay it. Or I think it happened with like Bitcoin in some way, where I'm still really bullish on Bitcoin, you know, but it has this environmental impact, you know. And I think the way I look at some of these situations is if you zoom out, I think with those two cases I just mentioned, politics and Bitcoin, I think there are people who are working on these problems, and there are potential optimistic futures for improving those paths and making them so that they are more scalable and are more efficient for the world to actually accept. If that didn't exist, I would 100% agree and just join that crowd and say, hey, you know, this doesn't make the entire world better. Let's not. So I feel the same way about the $5 ENS example I just shared. I feel like it's a milestone, and then there's more work to do. The milestone that it helps to hit is it gives us some data on proof of personhood, right? And proof of humanity. And it helps us eliminate 80% of the bots. For a large percentage of the world, we could probably say, what, there's like 8 billion people on the planet. We could probably say at least 3 or 4 billion could afford that, you know, roughly, just making rough numbers up. So I think that is a large part of the world. But you do bring up a good point. You know, how do we then scale that? I think from there, over time, these technologies will get better. And there are, I could list a few, you know, alternative ways that are other ways to add friction that aren't $5, you know, whether it's like sharing your ID, whether it's like, I haven't looked at WorldCoin enough, but I know that WorldCoin is working, Sam Altman's project, working on looking, giving tokens based on an eye retina scan, which is, I mean, I feel like I could play devil's advocate to this myself too, where I could say like, you know, so, okay, you don't have enough money. Now you have to give up your like eye retina scan and privacy. I think there are trade-offs at all different levels, but I think if we come at it with a good mind for like how we could scale it long-term, I do think that is an important piece on the table. And so I don't think we should stop at this, you know, but I don't know all the answers for sure.
Oh, it's definitely a spectrum, you know, definitely like as far as anything concerns, it's a spectrum. I'm not talking just about decentralization. I think life is a spectrum, right? Anything on it is just another spectrum for us to zoom in, zoom out. Like you said, I'm going to be devil's advocate one last time because I really want to hear your opinion here. And you mentioned it like a few times. You mentioned bots a few times. I'm personally connected with several AI projects and there is a few that I'm really curious. I'm not talking about just crypto right now. I'm talking about in general artificial intelligence. And I'm curious as to your opinion as to somebody who's creating the decentralized social network. And I personally was involved in the launch of a decentralized social network in 2016. And there was a lot of failures that we did. A lot of the experiment didn't really work out. One of the biggest questions we had, and you mentioned it several times today, a bot and a person. Why is it such a big problem? Why do we need to eliminate the bots? I mean, at which point did the world suddenly decide that a bot isn't an entity who is allowed to exist by itself freely without being proven that it's not a bot? And I'm not talking about, you know, stupid. I mean, of course, there has to be, like we said, a spectrum, some gradation probably. But somewhere along the line in 10 years' time, and maybe even less, I'm sure that bots are going to be capable of proving to be human, right? So this is the question. Why are we so afraid to make that step and to say, hey, okay, any account with a private or a public key is an account. Whether it's a bot or a human, that is already a different story. But what's the reason we are afraid of that as humanity?
Yeah, when I describe bots, it's a word that I'm using to describe accounts that are, I would say, detracting value from communities. So I think on Twitter, that tends to be accounts. So I'm using bots to describe sock puppets, which is to define that, which is essentially when you masquerade as a different account, right? So, you know, I could have like a computerized thing saying it's Chris and you think you're talking to me, but it's kind of masquerading, kind of like a sock puppet on your hand, or bots that are just spamming, or bots that are just like even, you know, retweeting and just commenting and liking and stuff. You know, what they do is they detract from like the authentic value of the system. And I think in some ways, most of the world politically leans toward a liberal democracy. This is the kind of generic state of the world right now, like the default, I would say. A lot of people share those values. And I believe we also tried to create those values in the programs in the digital world. We want Twitter, for example, to have these qualities of a democracy, which in a lot of ways mean one person should have a voice, right? They should have freedom of speech. There should be not censorship, but a reasonable, if somebody, you know, basically screams fire, you know, or is basically like saying something malicious that we can, you know, to have these triggers. And I'm just kind of reflecting what, for example, Twitter is, just as one example. But I think we try to follow these habits when we create ecosystems online. So bots come in and they are able to manipulate that, usually at the expense of one person, could spin up thousands of bots and then create and manipulate public opinion. So that's what I mean by bots. So I don't think that that is helpful. It tends to, yeah, really just break communities. And, you know, in the case of Discord, just because that's something we've studied a lot over the past year, also steal hundreds of millions of dollars of funds by masquerading as other people. So they don't create value in that way, but they can't, a bot being just in the most simple way, like an automated thing to reply to. I agree. Like there is a, it can be helpful, right, to help with automated tasks, but it's when it's being controlled like a puppet that I think, and can be manipulative in these kind of ways, that it really erodes the value of the ecosystem, sometimes without us even knowing that that's happening, which is really nefarious.
I'm going to make a cruel joke. When you say manipulated like puppets, you mean like Cambridge Analytica did with millions and tens of millions of humans and influenced the election of every single existing election on the planet? Is that what we mean by that?
I 100% mean what Cambridge Analytica, yeah, and the and specifically to add to that, you know, the Internet Research Agency in out of Moscow, which is like a troll factory that basically helps create a lot of this manipulation and bots.
I'm saying they use real people, not just bots. They turn people into bots, into the bots you're describing.
They turn people into bots. Yes.
That's the scary thing, right? Chris, I did mention that I was involved in an experiment with trying to launch the decentralized social networks in 2016. Well, not trying, we launched and we did it. It actually exists today without any team or anything like that. It exists by itself. The biggest problem we faced was the economical side of things. The economical side of things for us was a failure. I'm not talking about budgeting and managing to budget. I'm talking about simply we couldn't find a model that wasn't able to be milked by the users and at the same time was beneficial to the users. So how do you guys solve this at Console XYZ? And what do you do? Do you completely eliminate the economy side? Or is there some economics involved? And how does it work in Console?
Do you mean how do we make money?
No. I'm sorry. My apologies. What about the users, the incentives? What is the incentive to use Console XYZ? And how do the users keep engaged in using Console XYZ?
So one important thing to share is that we are in this beta period right now of co-creation with the communities that are on Console. So what that means is if you are on Console or you want to come to Console and you're a part of our beta, not only are you benefiting from being able to use our improved platform, this better security, beautiful design, but you're also able to share and grow with us. And we are trying to learn from the communities that we're working on. So what are we learning? One of the things that we're learning that I think is super interesting and relevant to your audience is that onboarding right now for new community members is really broken across different Discord, Telegram platforms. We're noticing how by watching communities, if you're starting up a new community or you have a community and you send people the link, a lot of people who are new, especially people who aren't used to these platforms, come into Discord and they're so excited and they want to contribute and they want to learn or buy your NFT, and they get in the middle and there's just so much noise and it's just like, what is happening here? So one of the benefits that we're able to learn from the communities that are using Console is to have a better onboarding experience so that you can give a link and then they can have just like a beautiful experience of that first moment coming on the platform. We have a docs feature, which is token gated docs, so that now someone has clicked the link, they've signed in or signed with their MetaMask if they need to, and then they're able to read the docs, kind of come through the flow and learn about the project. Think of it as like an operating system for Web3. So you come in and you're onboarded, you understand what the community is about, but not only that, you can understand where all of the different component pieces, like what Web3 does really well is, I think of it as like a bunch of different Lego blocks that we can interconnect. It's open, it's transparent, it's on the blockchain. The blockchain is essentially like this database that we're all sharing, right? That never goes down, hopefully. And that's really powerful for us to tap into that. And that's what we're doing at Console. So we provide chat, we provide that onboarding, and then we allow communities to use all these Lego blocks to help build their community as they need. If they need a treasury, we'll provide access to that. If they need voting, we provide access to that. We can help work with these communities to help them grow as they need.
Another thing that I guess I saw as an obstacle, not during that time, but actually with another project, and I'm curious how you guys solved it, was the whole idea of creating a social network, a decentralized social network, which would have the same level of security as blockchain kind of thing. And I've seen a project, and I want to go like into names, of course, here, so not to take focus of you. But the idea was that the problem, sorry, was that people were just not ready for that. Like, you know, like Web3 using a ledger to make a tweet or something like that. Or like, well, what's going on? People were like mind blown. We're like, okay, it's not going to use that, of course. And at the same time, you saw people on Twitter saying, oh, we really need this stuff. You know, Twitter is being hacked. We really, really, really need this stuff, you know, and like stuff like that. So how do you guys solve that? What's your solution here?
Yeah, to let you in on some of the thoughts that were conversations that we're having right now internally, we think it's really important, number one, important to make an app that solves people's day-to-day problems. It needs to be a beautiful, usable app that people can get onboarded to. Because, you know, a lot of these things that you're listing there and that Web3 chants about decentralized, private, open source, ownership, like these are all a lot of the key principles of Web3. I do believe that those are really important. And I do believe those are a foundation for building the future of communities. And at the same time, the whole basket for many people, for me and you, it might be enough, but for most people, that basket's not enough. Most people are struggling right now to build their, to grow their size of their community, to monetize their project, to have outreach with the people who are in their community. And if we're Discord or Telegram, they may not know even who's in there, who's active, you know, all of these things. So at Consul, the way we're approaching it is like, that really is the number one problem. It is figuring out how to help people grow their communities, to focus, to have essentially like a CRM to manage the most active people, to reward those people. All of that is really like the sweet spot. And we know we need to do it on that core foundation of all those Web3 principles, because that's where the future is going. And I think this recipe, any startup who's listening, I think really needs to adopt this in the next year, because this year to me really proved that that market, if we talk about product market fit, having a market for a product that's going to create value for your project, the market for people in crypto is so small. The people who are actually active, I want to say it's less than 100,000 people if you just use the number of people who are active on crypto Twitter, right? And so that's not enough to really build a business, to grow a future. Either we onboard more people into our tribe, possible, it is growing, it will continue to grow, or what I think is the winning solution, we take what we're doing, export it as the foundation to just amazing apps that people can seamlessly use. And in 10 years from now, I think if they don't even know it's on the blockchain or identities, that's even better. I don't think people have to know this. Just as today, you know, when we switched on the web from HTTP to HTTPS, I think most people can't name the date when that happened or why that happened, but it is like a huge innovation in privacy. But we're all benefiting from that, and you can benefit from that without knowing it. And I think Web3 has to be the same way.
A lot of the things you talk about, content and privacy, and you mentioned content before at the beginning, not right now, but it's a big thing, obstacle for myself personally. I have a team, and often people on the team change, so every now and again, and it's very hard to explain to them why we want to own our content, why we are using Spotify, why are using Google to put out the podcast, but it's very hard to explain to them why do I need to store that file in IPFS, or why do I need to, like, you know, go on and do some crazy thing, which doesn't really make sense, because like, hey, you can go and do that, but that is not the internet that we kind of own. So I totally understand what you're saying there. And from that, like a question, from what you were describing, and you mentioned the words operational system, I don't know if you heard of such a project called Urbit, because you mentioned communities and operational system, and I'm curious at all, are you guys connected? Are you doing, like, in terms of what you're doing in Consul, is it anyhow similar division to what Urbit has? Or
yeah, I don't know enough about Urbit, so maybe you can tell me more. I've heard a lot about the project, but yeah, tell me a little more.
As far as I know, and I'm definitely not affiliated with anyhow anybody there, but so it's going to be a very subjective personal opinion. Well, it's all about private servers, but a lot of their thing is built on communities, like about owning your server. And it's not actually a blockchain project as per se, but the identity in there is using Ethereum. And a lot of it is about building your own community in a decentralized space. And they're like very, like you said, building blocks by blocks, all of their operational systems, so to speak, and adding part to part to it. And from what you were describing, it sounded like you have guys a lot of similar growth ideas.
Cool. That sounds amazing. Have you interviewed them on the podcast or?
Unfortunately not. Unfortunately, I have not. No, but I guess I need to go out there and do it.
Yeah, I've heard a lot about it. So I'm excited to learn more.
For sure. Chris, another question. You've seemed to make a large journey with what you did. And you said the project is only a year, but from what you're explaining, I mean, what you guys are doing are very like slow steps that make, based on experience of what you want to see or what you would expect to see or something like that, what would be your advice, apart from the one you said a couple of minutes ago, to people that are building Web3 projects and trying to grow their communities and trying to succeed in this space?
Yeah, having run a few startups in Web2, let's say, or before Web3, and coming to the space, a lot of the same principles apply as far as growing a project. For example, like I mentioned, having product market fit, I mean, there's a lot that I think users could read about that and learn about that. But really, one ingredient of that would be just growth. And so having a metric for growth, whether it's people coming and using your app or paying for your app, is still really important. And I think that that starts with just observing how people use these tools, understanding the problems, and experimenting, and, you know, hopefully iterating on those experiments until you hit something to make something that people love. And that's essentially like the startup framework. If you read Paul Graham's blog or the Lean Startup book, you know, this is essentially that playbook. And in a lot of ways, I don't know that that has changed all that much. To me, launching an NFT or launching a token is largely fundraising. You know, if you're paying for it, it's largely a way of bringing funds to the project. It's largely a way of bringing in some of your first users. But that in alone is not a business plan, you know, or like a goal. Like that's not like the end goal. I think that's like the startup, you know, the bootstrapping goal. And so I would like to see more projects, I think, hitting the real problems that real people have. I think we've spent a lot of time working on infrastructure, and there's a lot of people working on infrastructure and the lower level stuff. And it does still need a lot of work. And at the same time, I feel like there's a lack of real world utility for how we use these apps, you know, how someone who is not into Web3 could benefit from a Web3 app. And I think we're close. I think there's a lot of projects that are starting to get closer to that every, you know, year after year. I think we get closer and closer to that. But I think that's the equation, is just finding growth in users and solving real problems. And then I think people will come. And I think together, it's a small space. I think together we can raise a lot of awareness for what I like to call a user-owned internet. I mean, it's essentially what we're making, an internet that's owned by the people who use it, as opposed to just a handful of corporations that, you know, as we have it now. I think that is the future. And I think, you know, we're on our way to that. And so I'm excited for anybody who's stepping up to build in that space.
What about the one thing to avoid?
Oh, man. So many things. I think building too long without having a customer is a similar kind of advice, but literally finding that first customer could be such unlock. And I think building, because I've seen people build for years and still maybe nobody's using it. I think if you build without customers, it's really bad. I also think fundraising can be a mix.
Madesafe? Madesafe came to mind. I don't know if you know the project Madesafe. The guys are also building a similar thing to you, but they've been building for like 15 years or something like that. So sorry to interrupt you there. So
no, I hadn't heard of that, but I guess that's the point of what you're trying to tell me, is that it exists. But yeah, the final thing I was just saying is I think fundraising can be like a pro and a con as someone who's gone through fundraising rounds. I think seed round can be nice as a way to kind of kickstart the project, but I think just also to be careful about taking too much money or relying too much on that, because sometimes incentives can get misaligned and then you end up building something that even you don't want.
For sure. Chris, I know you are short on time. I know that. So I'm going to go to the last question, to the Blitz. The Blitz is three questions. You don't have to answer super quick, but I know you have almost no time. So it depends on you. three projects outside the top 20, please don't say Bitcoin, Ethereum, or Cosmos, or Polkadot, that you're curious in terms of what they're doing and you're curious the technology they're building?
Yeah, ENS comes to mind. I don't know if that counts on your list, but ENS is doing some pretty great work with coming up with like a global identity for users on the internet. I think that's really powerful. In addition, I think a lot of the stuff Protocol Labs is doing is still early days with IPFS and Filecoin and decentralized storage. I think removing storage from centralized servers is really a huge innovation, but it's still pretty early days. I think it's coming along, but it's still early days. And a third project,
doesn't have to be, you don't have to push it out of yourself. It could be two, you know, there's no pressure here.
Yeah, those two come to mind.
What about two motivational things that keep you going in your daily life to build on the products that you are building? I know you're writing a book as well, and I know there is a lot of other things you do. So teaching, for example, what are those two motivational things that you would share with other people that help you to do those, everything that you do, sorry?
Yeah, I'm inspired by, I don't know if you're familiar with Stuart Brand. He started The Long Now, which is a way of looking at humanity in kind of a zoomed out way. There's a really beautiful book that he wrote called The Clock of the Long Now, which I really love. It's just a handful of essays. It's like less than 100 pages. And the idea of long-term thinking is looking at problems that you can work on your life that might not be solved even in the time of your life, right? Like there's some really big challenges like climate change, for example, is a problem that will still be a problem, I'm certain, you know, in 80 years from now. It won't just have gone away, I don't think. It may hopefully be less, or we will have gone away, but I don't think it will. I don't think it'll just, you know, I think it'll still be a challenge. So I think there's something, yeah, really inspiring and optimistic of zooming out, thinking about children and our children's children and what we can leave and leave a better world for them. And so I'm just kind of endlessly, I don't know where I got it from, but just optimistic about the future. And I think that we right now have the ability to create the future, right? Why wait for the future? Like when you can create it. And I think there's never been a more exciting time since maybe the 90s with the web, right? The first web that there is now, where there's just all of these technologies, not only Web3, but also AI. There's just been such a leapfrog. You know, there was like 10 years, I feel like most of the 10s to 20, like to end, you know, 2010 to like 2018, where there like wasn't so much innovation. There was like APIs and there was like some stuff, but now there's just such an array of technology where if you started learning AI right now and you studied every single day and start building stuff, and like a year and a half from now, you'd be like in the top of people. I don't know, you'd probably be like the top 1,000 or maybe 10th. You'd be like the top, you know, of people. Because it's so new, there's so much, you could have all these different ways you could travel with it. So it's hard not to be inspired, but if you just think about the future and think about the impact you can have and just think about, it's never been easier to get started, you know, I think it's pretty exciting.
Last one, and you kind of already answered, but you might change your mind. One person that you would suggest to follow, writer, GitHub account, I don't know, crypto founder, non-crypto related person, one person that you would suggest to everybody to follow or to read?
I am really a big fan of Stuart Brand, who I mentioned. I think his book, Clock of the Long Now, is a really great one. And, you know, Stuart Brand helped kickstart the internet itself in the 1960s. So there's this kind of angle of tech and humanity, I think, in all his work. And I'll also give a shout out to Kevin Kelly, who is, I would say, the right word, like he learned under Stuart Brand, like kind of an apprentice or whatever. So Kevin's a little bit younger, and his book Out of Control I read when I was in college, and Out of Control came out in the 90s. It was funny kind of trivia about the book Out of Control. It was like required reading for everyone in the Matrix movie. Just like a weird trivia.
All right.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Because in the 90s, Kevin Kelly saw the power of decentralized systems. And if you look on the cover, it's all bees, like in like a technological hive. But he basically saw the decentralized movement and how we would all be kind of creator bees. And that's what the book's about. And a lot of the lessons still are true today. And I think a lot of it has seeped into a lot of the products and founders over the past 20 years. So that book in particular is also another one. And I guess it makes sense. The two of them both work Clock of the Long Now and are friends because they're both think about a lot of the same things, which I think are relevant for Web3.
I think, yeah, definitely. The Wachowski brothers back then.
Yeah.
They had a fantastic vision. Sometimes I'm not sure if that was the vision they had because it's too perfect. It's like, how the hell did you manage to...
Wow.
I think it was a mistake. Yeah. Like, no way you could have envisioned that. Like, no way. It's like, but yeah,
wow.
Of course.
I agree.
Yeah, it's crazy. Chris, Kastig, all of them together, thank you very, very much. I still have some questions for you, but I know you're out of time and I know you have to run. So thank you very, very, very much for joining me. And hopefully we will see how the involvement of console XYZ more and more and more. And I'm hoping that you will be able to onboard a lot more users than other social networks before that managed to do. And I hope Ines will help you in that journey.
Thanks, Serge. Yeah, it's been great being on your podcast. I really appreciate you coming and asking any questions today and just feel really lucky to spend some time with you today. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks, everybody. Bye.
This content was created by the Citizen Cosmos Validator. If you enjoyed it, please support us by delegating to Citizen Cosmos and help us to create more educational content.